The American economic sector of choice today? Farms. The ag economy in the Trump era, straight ahead from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 8th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Dateline, Nashville, Tennessee, the annual convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation, commonly known as the Farm Bureau. But more to the point, its keynote speaker, the President of these United States. Setting aside for a second the text of what the president said, there is a whole lot about the Trump administration and the American agriculture economy that does deserve some time. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been covering the speech for us. Hey, Kimberly.
Hi, Kai.
So this was an interesting speech, just in terms of how much time the president gave to actual farm issues. What do you suppose the farmers in the audience thought they wanted to hear, and what did they hear?
Well, what they heard was a lot about how great the new tax plan is going to be for them. The president particularly highlighted the immediate expensing of equipment that's included under the new tax law, which basically will allow farmers, if they buy, say, a new combine, to write off 100% of that cost in the first year they have it. That is a big deal.
Yeah.
But he didn't necessarily spend as much time on some of the other really big issues, like regulations, trade, labor issues. He touched on them, but not for very long.
Talk to me for a second, then, would you, about the Trump administration and farmers and how they're getting by?
So, yeah, let's pick on those issues I just mentioned. So, for example, if you take regulations, the Trump administration has actually been rolling back a lot of regulations, particularly around water issues, that the farm industry thought were oppressive or costing them a lot of money. Now, some in the farming community will say that those rollbacks actually harm competition or hurt smaller farmers. But overall, they often like it. But then there's still a lot of uncertainty around issues like NAFTA and immigration.
Yeah, so about NAFTA. I mean, farmers benefit hugely, have benefited hugely under NAFTA. The president, as you know, has been talking about it going away. I think he gave two sentences to NAFTA in this speech, right?
Yeah, he didn't weigh on it too much. He was saying it's been bad for America. He's going to renegotiate it. But farmers have actually done pretty well by NAFTA, like you said. And this is actually something that USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue mentioned at an event at the National Press Club that I attended a couple of weeks ago.
Our president, as you know, is very concerned about our trade deficit, and I'm prone to remind him every time I'm in his presence that agriculture contributes to a trade surplus, and he needs to recognize that.
Huh. So let me give you a couple of numbers here, Kai. Canada, last year, we exported about more than $20 billion worth of agriculture goods to Canada, another $17 billion plus to Mexico. And so these are big numbers for the ag industry. And Perdue admits he differs from the president a bit on this, but he thinks that we're going to end up on another better negotiated NAFTA. But the rhetoric around this from the administration is still pretty worrying.
Wasn't it Perdue who showed the president a map of folks that voted for him, and he said, look, sir, they're all farmers, right? Wasn't that the deal?
Yeah, it's in a constituency the president needs to notice.
Get me back to immigration, would you, and the policies that this White House does on immigration and farming, which, as we know, is very labor-intensive.
Very labor-intensive and often very reliant on migrant labor, because even though there are more machines on farms than ever today, there are still some things that machines just don't do very well, like pick delicate berries or even do some jobs in the dairy industry. And the president is being very tough on immigration, in particular people who are here illegally. And that's actually very concerning to a lot of the farmers, especially large agribusiness, because there's already a labor shortage in this industry, and they're worried that without more immigrants coming in, especially from Central America, that it's actually going to get worse. And so that's a big push from the Farm Bureau, actually, to get the administration to work on some sort of comprehensive immigration reform that's going to still get them the labor they need.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams covering the president's speech today at the Farm Bureau convention. The first time in 25 years, it should be said, that an American president has spoken to that group. Kimberly, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Kai.
On Wall Street today, stock of the day? Take a guess. Anybody? Ticker symbol, WTW, Weight Watchers, up 12.1%. Why, you ask? Well, a little speech last night at the Golden Globes by the company's spokesperson and major shareholder. Oprah Winfrey owns 10% of the company, worth something like $300 million, her slice is. The three major indices, a little bit up, a little bit down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been 110 days today since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. And along with the huge and devastating personal and human impact of that storm, the wrecked infrastructure on that island, the Associated Press reports more than 40% of the island's power customers are still without electricity. That impact is starting to be felt in the wider American economy, specifically here in flu season, in medical devices, in particular intravenous drip bags, IV bags as you know them, a big chunk of which are manufactured in Puerto Rico. Stephanie Armour wrote about the shortage for the Wall Street Journal today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
One of the people you talked to for this article said that this shortage of IV bags is a public health crisis. That sounds ominous.
It is. And in fact, I've heard from a number of individuals at hospitals just since our story ran who are echoing the same concern. You know, this is a shortage of these IV saline bags that has been around for a while. But the real concern is we're hitting the flu season and some hospitals really only have a day or two of supplies.
As opposed to what kind of supply when they're, you know, normally up and running?
4 to 5 days. And hospitals go through, you know, a large hospital can go through 1,000 or more of these bags in a day. So, you know, they're used for hydration, for mixing drugs that patients may get. And so a number of hospitals I've spoken to are concerned that the continuing shortage is really hitting at a bad time right now.
Tell me about this company, Baxter International, and its production facilities on Puerto Rico, which are still not up and running after Hurricane Maria.
Well, actually, they are up and running,
okay.
But the problem is that the power grid is unstable. So the FDA has described them, the production, as in a fragile state. So they are confident that they are going to be, you know, getting up and ramping up. But the problem is, the hospitals are already at such a shortage that they're concerned it's going to take really until March or so until they have back to their full supply that they need.
What do hospitals do if they haven't got the IV bags and people need the drugs?
That's a good question. I talked to a number of hospitals and they're all looking at various things. Some have tried to use empty bags. Some are looking at potentially postponing elective surgeries.
Wow.
And one hospital is actually looking at going back to glass bottles, which were, you know, back in the 1960s.
Wow. Also, you write having nurses just stand there and do the intravenous thing manually.
Right. This is called an IV push. And what they do is they put the drugs in a syringe and slowly inject it into the patient. But this can have more side effects. Typically, drugs are diluted in the saline bags and then administered over a period of time. So it can cause more itching or other sorts of problems for patients that way.
Any guesses as to when things will be back to normal, just in terms of the IV bag supply?
You know, they're hoping to ramp up, but the hospitals that I've spoken to said that they've kind of been hearing this before, and they're a little skeptical in terms of how quickly it will happen. Their big concern is this flu season is expected to be significantly more severe than others in the past. So they're kind of concerned about making sure they have adequate supply, especially in areas that may be more hard hit.
Stephanie Armour writing for the Wall Street Journal on health policy. Stephanie, thanks a lot.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Camas, Washington, a couple of hundred miles south of Seattle, has seen the future, and it is definitely not in paper. After more than 130 years in pulp, Georgia-Pacific announced a couple of months ago it's going to shut down most of its production in town, with hundreds of workers losing their jobs. That's an economic shock that might have doomed a lot of small towns with a one-industry history. Not, however, Camas. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Molly Solomon explains.
The papermaking past of Camas, Washington is entrenched in the town's DNA. Nowhere is that more apparent than when you walk into the high school auditorium, where the basketball team, the Papermakers, is playing its season opener. A banner with the school's fight song is decorated with rolls of toilet paper. And then there's Camas's mascot. It used to be Joe Papermaker, but now it's the Mean Machine, an animated paper roller that fires up the crowd during timeouts.
You always know Papermakers go rolling.
Sitting in the back row at the game is Wayne Rash. He's a former mill worker who graduated from Camas High in 1964.
I come to all the games. It doesn't matter what sport.
Rash says when he was growing up, almost everybody lined up for a job at the mill after graduation. Nowadays, most of the kids in this auditorium wouldn't even consider that.
Well, it used to be the only thing in town, but they've added a whole lot of industry here.
The mill will start to wind down paper and pulp operations in the spring, which means up to 300 people will likely lose their jobs. Regional state economist Scott Bailey says the loss of mills in the Pacific Northwest is nothing new. Since 2000, nearly 10 paper mills have shut down in Oregon and Washington.
Other areas, rural areas, where there's very few job opportunities left, and it's really devastated towns.
But Camas is different. In fact, many would argue it hasn't been a mill town for quite some time. Back in the late 70s, a big union strike threatened to bring the city to a halt. Nan Henriksen was the city's former mayor.
There were a lot of us that realized that the golden goose could die any moment, and we would be in financial ruin.
Nearly 70% of the city's property tax revenues came from the mill. Henriksen knew Camas needed to attract new industry. So when a plot of land became available, the city annexed it and turned it into a business park. But that had some wondering whether the city was losing its mill town roots.
That was a real time of crisis and questioning who we were and what we would be in the future.
Soon, high-tech companies like Hewlett-Packard, WaferTech, and Sharp moved in, bringing big money and white-collar jobs. Camas saw its population grow from about 6,000 to more than 20,000 in just two decades. Current Mayor Scott Higgins says all those changes mean Camas is really not a mill town anymore.
I think it's more psychological than it is financially for the majority of the residents of the city. I think for most people, it's more, wow, a piece of who we are is going away, and how do you replace that, or do you?
Now, Camas is praised as a model town. Its median income is close to $95,000, but there's still evidence of its papermaking roots. Daily reminders that can be found everywhere, including back at the high school. Last year, the city recognized the school's football championship win by renaming the street along the campus. It'll now be known as Papermaker's Way. In Camas, Washington, I'm Molly Solomon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
During class, I'm supposed to pay attention to the teacher, but I just have my head down reading.
Oh, I hear you, brother. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 12 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 25,283. The NASDAQ, let's try that one more time, 20 points to the good, 0.2%, 71.57. Come on, I've been sick. S&P 500 up 4 points, a 10%, 27.47. As the Consumer Electronics Show gets going in Vegas, the event's owners announced a study showing an uptick in tech as part of retail spending, all of those devices, obviously. Google parent company Alphabet up 0.3%, Microsoft lifted a 10%, Apple down 0.3%. Today, banks, J.P. Morgan Chase up a 10th, Bank of America down about 0.6%. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Item one on President Trump's public schedule today was his daily intelligence briefing at 11 o'clock this morning. Reports this weekend highlighted the increasing use of what the White House calls executive time in the president's workday, time thought to include his television and tweeting moments. This job is perhaps a different kind of executive function than this CEO turned president is used to, because executives in the private sector running publicly traded companies are more closely supervised in their jobs, primarily by their boards of directors. Jenna McGregor covers corporate management at The Washington Post. She's here to talk about those boards. Jenna, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Let's do a little definition here. What is a board's purpose? What is its job?
For a public company,
yeah,
a board of directors is a group of people, usually about 10 of them. Every public company must have them. Their primary jobs are to hire and fire the CEO, to act as fiduciaries for shareholders. In other words, acting in the shareholders' best interest. But then they also advise and provide oversight on things like strategy, corporate risk, the overall policies of the company. But they're not the ones making the typical day-to-day decisions.
Is it fair to say that they are the CEO's boss in a collective sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to play a piece of tape here. It's from Bill Ackman, a noted hedge fund guy. We've had him on the program. He does not have a high opinion of boards of directors, generally speaking. I'm going to play this piece of tape, and then we're going to talk about it. Here you go.
But being a director becomes a way to make a living when you're a retired CEO, and your willingness to challenge the status quo and to push back against the CEO, you become pretty quickly a director that doesn't end up on future boards. And you own very little stock in the company. And that's a dynamic that can lead to underperformance over extended periods of time.
Now, if you factor out Ackman's disdain for boards of directors of companies he's trying to take over or has launched a hostile bid against, which is most of them, the question that comes out of that piece of tape is, and I don't know how else to say this other than to say, it's mostly retired old white guys that you see on corporate boards.
Well, it is mostly retired old white guys. I'm not surprised by Ackman's view. He's an activist investor, mm-hmm. and by default, he's involved in trying to take action at companies where it's seen as not doing enough, that they're not operating as they should. And his point about them being risk averse has some truth to it. I mean, a board is composed of people who are well compensated. The largest companies pay their director a median of nearly $300,000 a year.
Oh, seriously?
Yes.
How do I get that job?
Something more.
That's a serious question. How do I get that job?
Well, there's two ways, really. You have to be nominated by the board of directors. There's a nominating committee who selects directors for the committee.
Yeah.
And increasingly, shareholders have a right to directly nominate directors to the board. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Kai, if you own a few shares in Apple or something, don't think this is going to be a right of yours. You have to be a very big institutional investor, somebody right. with a lot of shares to get
Man,
that right.
Wrecking my dream. Who gets credit for Apple's dominance in the space or Disney's dominance in the space? Tim Cook or the Apple board? Bob Iger or the Disney board?
Oh, definitely the CEO.
Really? Okay.
I mean, the CEO is the one making the day-to-day decisions. The board is acting in kind of an oversight and advisory capacity. He's going to run all of his big decisions, strategic ones, whether to buy a company, whether to go into a new strategic direction. Mm-hmm. They're going to be involved in big financial decisions like stock buybacks or dividends. But the CEO is leading and managing the company.
On a less tangible issue that is also very much in the news right now, what about stuff like sexual harassment and misconduct investigations and issues, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if there's somebody low ranking in the organization, right. you're not going to get the board involved. But if the CEO is involved or one of the very top layers of management is involved, you probably will. Boards, though, are paying attention to this issue. And it fits with this broader trend in on boards where they're suddenly saying, you know what, the culture of the company really matters. Mm. Look at Wells Fargo. Look at Uber. Look at all these companies that have had cultural issues really, really do some reputational damage to the company. And so you're seeing like HR people getting spots on boards, and you're seeing companies, boards say, you know what, culture matters. It's not just about the numbers, and we have to pay attention to this issue more.
So if I'm, you know, average person in this economy, maybe I've got a 401k and I've got some pension stuff going on and I got my kids' college fund someplace, how much should I be paying attention to corporate boards of directors?
Well, very few people do, but a couple things to look out for. One is, there are a lot of directors who are on a lot of boards. It's a phrase called being overboarded. You just don't want that because they're just too split. Another thing would be tenure. Have all of them been on the board for 20 years? Any kind of conflicts of interest? If there's, you know, too much of a close association with the CEO, those are all things that the average investor could probably spend a few minutes glancing and doing some Google searching and figure it out.
Jenna McGregor, she writes at the Washington Post. Jenna, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
There is more to our conversation between Jenna and me than could fit on the air, including a bunch more on what role the board of directors might play in, say, what it's like to be Bob Iger running Disney. You can hear that on our Corner Office podcast. Today in Apple definitely does not fall far from the tree overdue library book fines. Got an email from the local library the other day. One of the kids has a couple of books overdue, a chronic feature of my childhood. I spent a whole lot of my lunch money paying those fines, but in Los Angeles County, librarians are trying something a little bit different. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
Sixth grader Jonathan Morales gets in trouble at school for possibly the best reason.
I get in trouble for reading.
He's a reader.
During class, I'm supposed to pay attention to the teacher, but I just have my head down reading.
What are you reading?
Good books, necessarily.
Not bad books.
Yeah, not bad books.
Jonathan checks out those good books, lots of comics, from the East Los Angeles Library. And sometimes he holds on to them for a little too long.
And then when we look for the receipt, we lose the receipt, so we don't know when we're supposed to turn it in. We're human. We make mistakes.
The size of his current mistake? 24 overdue books, $28 in fines. Lucky for him, LA County launched a program last summer that lets anyone 21 or younger sit in the library and read away their fines. That's what Jonathan was doing when I interrupted him. He was there with his mom, Elizabeth Morales.
It's a good thing that we have this program because sometimes we don't have money to pay.
Jonathan knocks $5 off the fine for every hour that he reads. Since the program launched, the county has already cleared more than 3,500 blocked accounts. Darcy Hastings is LA County's Assistant Library Administrator for Youth Services.
We know that once a few dollars accumulate, sometimes, a lot of times, the cards just stop being used, and that doesn't help anybody.
She says in addition to letting people read away their old fines, the county last month decided to do something even bolder. It's now offering a new library card to students 18 and younger, a card that allows them to check out up to 3 books at a time with 0 penalty for late returns. Hastings says the county, along with a small but growing list of places, have decided that the use of fines makes libraries unwelcoming. And
what hasn't done what it was designed to do, which was to get the book back on time so somebody else could borrow it.
Hastings says it seems many people don't respond to the threat of a fine, but she's not sure why.
Maybe we need a behavioral economist to actually figure that out for us.
Okay.
My name is Uri Gnizi, and I'm a behavioral economist at the University of California, San Diego.
Gnizi says it's because library fines are too small. When they're just 15 cents a day, a dollar a week, they are not much of a deterrent.
That basically says to the reader, well, it's not that bad to be late. Now you're telling me that it's only $1 bad, then I might as well do it.
He says either hike the fine by, like, a lot, or get rid of it altogether.
No fine promotes better behavior than a small fine.
Without money in the mix, Gnizi says readers are more likely to return books on time because it's the right thing to do.
In psychology, it's called communal relationship. You don't want it to become an exchange relationship. Like when you go to the supermarket, you expect to pay for things. It's fine. You think that libraries want to be in the communal world.
But truth is, they're also in the financial world. L.A. County says it can afford getting rid of fines. They make up less than 1% of its $200 million library budget. But for smaller places like the Ohoopee Regional Library System in Georgia,
we shouldn't have to balance the budget with fines, but it's really the only way we can.
Cameron Asbell is the director of the library system. She says those 20 cents a day add up to more than $13,000 in annual fines.
I'd say in one of my counties, the fines account for about half of the book money. So we couldn't buy books without fines.
But Asbell says she doesn't want kids to think of librarians as these unforgiving, forever shushing guardians of books. She says that's how her town saw one of her old librarians.
She rode out with the sheriff's deputy and would knock on doors to get the materials back.
Luckily for those people, that librarian is now retired. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the pages of the Sydney, Australia Morning Herald, an easier way to get free coffee than those oh-so-low-tech consumer loyalty cards. A coffee shop in Sydney hooked up a couple of iPads with facial recognition software. It points one at customers to scan their faces, their biometrics. The other one faces the barista, gives them their names and usual orders. Bob's your uncle. You're out the door in a jiffy. You might scoff, as did I, but hey, the owner says his bottom line is up 37% in 2 years. All right, we got to go. That's it for a Monday. The Dow Industrials off about a tenth percent today, 25,283. NASDAQ up 0.2%, 75.57. NASDAQ up about a tenth percent, 27.47. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.